Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. It kind of comes down to you don't know what you don't know until you know it. Unless you are exposed to it, unless you have the opportunity to search it out, to investigate, etc., etc. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We archive the podcasts at both Richard Dugan, the radio show's page, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And we link to our guests' website so that you can continue your search to learn about what you don't know that you should know, at least from the standpoint that at least you're now aware of it. Whether you continue to pursue it, that's entirely up to you. But it seems to me, very interestingly enough, that as I have said many times on this program, as an advocate, a very, very strong proponent of education, hopefully educators are teaching people how to think and not what, but that they're exposing them to a lot of different things. I remember world history from grade school. I don't know if I took it in high school or not, but there are so many things I'm learning now that I wasn't told back then. Whether it was because of a lack of time in the semester, or if it was something that was just left out. Didn't know that much about mythology until I did that 12-part series with Will Lynn called Mythosophia, Exploring the Depths of Myth and Wisdom, and on and on and on. So please, if you've finished the first 12 grades, you've gone through post-secondary and maybe graduate school, you've got your PhD and your master's, your education isn't over, I guarantee you, because there's still so much out there. And today is no exception. We are hopefully going to educate you. In my therapy session, I'm hoping to get a little more educated as well. We're going to learn something new. We're going to learn about a new psychology of thinking, and it is called Mental Ingents. It's kind of like intelligence, but mental ingents. And I'm probably mispronouncing it. Dr. Kristen Lee, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. Tell me, how is that pronounced?
Mentelligence.
Mentelligence. Okay. Put too many syllables in there. And it is, as you say in the subtitle, a new psychology of thinking. Basically, we'll be able to learn what it is to be more aligned, agile, mindful, and connected in today's world. It's funny. I read that silently to myself before we went on the air, and I still read that word agile incorrectly. How to affect positive change in your world and beyond. And I also had the opportunity to watch your TED Talk, which, first of all, must have been quite an experience. I remember when they first started coming out, and I used to wonder if I really had anything to contribute that could be put into a TED Talk. I met someone who went through the process, which is very, I want to say, arduous by their description, but is quite gratifying. They were so thrilled to have been asked. You talked about in that TED Talk, which is aligned with what we're going to be discussing here. there was an acronym that you presented, ASSES, to your students. I thought that was funny, and I also noticed that there was a joke you made that the audience didn't get. It went right over their heads. But it was very interesting when you talked about being your authentic self versus conforming to what the society says. And one of the thoughts that came to my mind was, but the society is made up of these individual people. So it's like, how do we separate those aspects of being authentic and so to speak, thinking for ourselves, but at the same time acknowledging, of course, as you put it quite well, when you hurt, I hurt, and when you are joyful and so forth, so am I. Can you elucidate a little bit on that as we get started here?
Absolutely. It's just such a delight to be with you. And I love how, you know, just as you're starting the conversation, framing the whole idea of what we don't know. And for me as an educator, you know, I have the privilege to work with lots of students from around the world. And I often tell them that, you know, the true marker of learning is really unlearning what we've been taught and then going through a process of relearning. And certainly that can come with a lot of excitement and energy, but also sometimes it can be a disruptive thing to embrace because, you know, it can be anxiety provoking recognizing how many different ways we can look at situations and how we can see ourselves and one another in completely new ways than we've originally been taught. For me, the TED Talk, and I think this just connects so well with what you're really trying to elevate, which is our stories, right? Mm-hmm. And lots of times in life, I think we're taught to be put into a box, to show up, to fake it till you make it kind of thing. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of fear and trepidation that we feel as we go out, we seek to kind of make our mark in the world. And, you know, as human beings, we really have the primitive instinct to want to be part of a social group, to want to have a sense of belonging and a sense of connection. And those are all vital aspects of our lifeblood and our well-being. But what can happen in today's hyper-competitive market where, you know, we're sold the message that we have to start our own nonprofit by the time we're 12, or that we have to have the Kardashian rear end, or, you know, we have to have all these letters after our name or tons of money accumulated. We know overwhelmingly that the science says that that doesn't actually contribute to happiness, and sort of thinking of it like the goods life versus the good life. Mm-hmm. And the good life is really characterized by a sense of being present with ourselves, with one another, you know, not buying into society's prescriptions for so-called success that we know often not only don't lead us to happiness, but can lead us to, you know, destructive behaviors, to unhealthy behaviors, to burnout, depletion, and, you know, lots of depression and anxiety as well.
Well, you know, it's one of the reasons I don't go and haven't gone to any of my class reunions. Because I don't want, you know what? I just put myself up on Facebook for this radio program. Uh-huh. About 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, I had a Facebook account and then I deleted it. I just got rid of it, which was a process in and of itself. Now with all of the brouhaha over privacy and all these kinds of things and being manipulated by information that we may have put in there, you know, it quite honestly astounds me that anybody is really boggled by this, why they would be frustrated, because in 1994, when I first became an AOL subscriber and was online, the moment I went online, I knew my privacy was gone. I just instinctively knew that forget about it. Whatever I put up there is going to be there forever. And mm-hmm. So that was one of the reasons why a few years ago I said no more with the Facebook because I just don't have the time to maintain this thing. Mm-hmm. I've learned a few things since then, so I went ahead and did this. And then I'm sitting here thinking, gee, is Facebook going to be around much longer with the with all of the stuff that's going on? But I've seen some things. I've said this on the program in previous weeks when once I had the Facebook account for Tell Me Your Story. I will not friend you if I don't know you. Mm-hmm. Flat, short and simple. I don't like anything. I do not click like for, not even for my relatives. I mean, I found cousins I didn't even know existed. I am connected with my mother and father, my two older sisters, I think my two younger sisters. I'm not sure if my brother's even on Facebook, but haven't connected with him there. Nieces, nephews. Well, I should say nieces. I only have one grand nephew, and he's only a year old, so he's not online until next year. But I find it interesting how we are so surprised. I posted something on Facebook to the whole thing. They had Zuckerberg's picture up there and mm-hmm. comments about the whole thing, and so I said basically, why are you people surprised? This is no different than the 1950s when the movie industry was caught sticking an advertisement frame into every 24th frame of a movie, subliminal advertising. Why are you surprised at what has happened here? Whether or not anybody's guilty of anything or they were hacked and the information was stolen, to me makes no difference. And isn't that the objective of advertising and marketing, to convince you in whatever way they can to buy their product or service, or, you know, to go along with their particular ideology or belief or philosophy and so forth? And that's one of the things that I don't know. Maybe it's because of that lack of education that I keep hearing that our educational system has been dumbed down. And I heard that back in the 70s when I was still in the system, you know, and I got a little concerned about that. But is that part of the problem that we have, that it's sort of like a magician? Our society is sort of like a magician. And part of the objective of a magician is to redirect your attention away from whatever they're doing, like with the right hand is waving over here, hey, look over here, but the left hand is over here on the left doing something else that you're not aware of because your attention is being attracted to his right hand. Is that part of where we have sort of slipped off, as it were, because we have not, how do I put this? We haven't been really taught the aspects of critical thinking and how to think and processing information in certain ways, as opposed to being told what to think and this is true and this isn't true and so forth. And we've been told not to question and so forth. I mean,
there's so many, you know, this is such a great example, and there's so many factors at play, right, that kind of cause our minds to quickly, you know, make judgments or assumptions about the information we're receiving. And one of the ways we can think about it is, you know, there's a word called infobesity, right? So they're saying we're gorged with so much information coming in at a breakneck speed.
How many newspapers did you say in the TED? How many newspapers did you say in the TED Talk? 140?
Yeah, so they say we take 174 newspapers a day, Richard. Can you believe that? So that is just like the complete brain overload, right? And so, you know, we have, again, access to more information than ever before. And, you know, to your point about, and for me as an educator, you know, I'm in a full-time role at Northeastern University in Boston. As I said, I have the privilege of teaching students from across the world, and I lead the behavioral science department. So psychology is a science, you know, that has a strong emphasis on the rigorous process of critical thinking and looking at evidence and, you know, coming to more calculated decisions and resisting the urge of the brain to be centric and kind of just locking down in the ways you've always done things or been taught, or else self-protection. You know, we're very wired to self-protect our own interests, so ourselves and our loved ones. Or we're also wired to kind of want to believe what's convenient to believe. So there's sort of all these natural trappings of, you know, that are generated through our primitive instincts and then also the ways that we've been raised that we have to be very cautious about because, you know, the implications are we can miss the whole point. Like you said, if the left hand is kind of, you know, diverting the attention, we divert, you know, we waste a lot of attention. We're consuming all this information. We waste a lot of attention on ways that we could actually be more positive, more productive, ways that we could work together, ways that we can actually, you know, have evidence-based knowledge, you know, things that we know are more powerful in terms of human development, human learning, and human progress. And, you know, as what happened for me is I was invited to teach a graduate course called Personal Branding at the university. And honestly, when I was first asked to do that, I cringed. I thought, oh, this is just another, you know, kind of creepy sales thing. The student's going to be asked to really, you know, pitch themselves and climb that ladder. And, you know, before I came into higher ed, I worked for 22 years as a clinician. So I'd seen a lot of people, you know, get misinformation and take these disastrous falls off the ladder. And, you know, again, when I think about some of the main messages that were given, there are these messages of hyper-performance that you have to be, you have to know everything and be right and be authoritarian. And really the true marker of someone who's, you know, growing and learning is that they know that it's a lifelong endeavor, that they have intellectual humility, that they understand the big discovery of modern day psychology, which is that our brains are more likely to get things wrong than they are right. And I don't know about you, but like, you know, as I reflect on that and as I've discovered that through the research I've done, it's like, oh, it's disruptive because we, you know, we think we're right or we take pride in ourselves or, you know, we think, oh, we can trust our gut instincts or we know these things. But what we really understand as we get more educated and as we open up our minds we recognize just how many lenses there are to see the world, and how, you know, there's just so many layers happening with any given phenomena. And so we've got to open ourselves up and be more agile rather than being rigid about our thinking. And I think especially if we look at, you know, our polarized socio-political climate, it's all about teams, it's all about sides, and there's very little listening that's happening. And we've lost that ability to really look at things through different perspectives and find ways to work together. So those end up being kind of the biggest perils of the misthinking. You know, certainly as consumers, we can end up making poor spending choices when marketers are trying to woo us in to believe things. Certainly the news media, they're chicken littling us into thinking the sky is falling and that everything's bad. We're not focusing on the positive data, the positive stories, the things that are working well. And so, again, a lot of these focal points came up in my teaching process. And then I launched an entire research study to try to look at what can help us with all this, what can contribute to our resilience, our identity, our sense of self as thinkers. And, you know, how do we unlearn those kinds of ways in a society that just kind of bears down on all of us? And, you know, move towards a better way so that we can not only, you know, be okay on an individual level, but we can improve as societies.
I mean, you've raised a lot of different points there. One thing that has always disturbed me, especially in, as you made reference to our current state of dealing with one another and the polarization, and you use the term team. I've heard tribe, the same kind of thing. And the one thing that has bothered, one of the many things I suppose that's bothered me, is the denigration in particular of the media. You can't even have a conversation anymore without somebody saying, well, where'd you get that information? Well, I got it from this. Oh, well, that's, they're inaccurate all the time, you know. They don't provide you with any information. And then, of course, you hear the term echo chamber, where many, many people on whatever tribe they belong to or team, they're only listening to the outlets that support their particular perspective or ideology or philosophy. When I was going to school back in the late 60s and into the 70s, and my official education ended in 79 or 80, only because I graduated from high school and took a 6-month sabbatical, went to junior college in Phoenix for 3 semesters, which was a lot of fun because I chose to go. I wanted to go. Whereas with primary and secondary, it wasn't as much of a choice. Your parents, they told you you were going, and you were going to learn something. But I always heard this phrase, go to the library and why don't you read a book and broaden your horizons. Mm-hmm. But today, that's the last thing anybody wants to do, is broaden their horizons. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I have learned more and been frustrated about what I wasn't told in history class in grade school and high school. Than when I was in those first 12 years. And it's like, really, I didn't. And here's just a case in point. You know, they say that the only place that the Japanese managed to infiltrate was Hawaii when they bombed Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. But that's not true. Here on the Central Coast, there are stories that were in the papers as well as eyewitnesses who saw the Japanese come up from submarines onto the shore. And what was funny was the citizens on the shore ended up scaring them back into their submarines and away. And I don't know how they did that, but all I know is that there is historical evidence that shows that the Japanese made it to the U.S. mainland. But have we ever been told that? No. When we were celebrating the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus back in the 90s, I thought there was only one version of his story. But by the time that sequence of months was over, I had 3 different versions of the history of Christopher Columbus. And the only thing I could think of was, as I take the same tack with mythology, well, there's got to be some truth in each one of those stories, and I'm just going to have to sift through and figure out what I think is the best, but still not really knowing for sure what the true history is. Mm-hmm. And then we're told that it is always when battles are won that the victors are the ones that write the history, not the losers. And so you don't get the whole story and so forth. But it's the denigration of the media. And then I think one of the greatest things to, and I've heard this said, to our democracy was when it was accused by a candidate that the system was rigged before the election. And I thought, wait a minute. If the system is rigged and you lose, we're never going to hear the end of it. But if you win, we'll never hear from you again, which wasn't the case. There was still a complaint that it was rigged and, you know, and so forth. And that has other issues. But it's like, okay, I said that I heard over the years that the educational system's being dumbed down. And over the course of decades, we kind of see there is some truth to that. In other institutions, it's the same thing. You talk in your book here, you're trying to encourage people to affect positive change. And I'm curious, in this environment that we have just sort of discussed, how in the world does someone do that when they're being inundated by all this stuff?
Ultimately, it's a phenomenal way to sort of analyze this because, again, we've talked about the news, we've talked about the education system, and really with this focus on this overload of information we're presented with and trying to make sense of it. So my study really became a catalyst for this creation of Mentelligence. So again, with the word Mentelligence, it's a fusion of the word mental and intelligence. And when we think about the connotation around mental health, mental disorder, mental problems, and then also intelligence has also been very narrowly defined and, you know, work by Howard Gardner out of Harvard and other scholars have shown like there's much more broader definitions. And so Mentelligence ends up, through this complete research process in my teaching and also my clinical work for many years, having worked with thousands of people and having them share their stories, what emerged were four different lenses that can help us, again, sort of navigate all this complexity and, you know, just make sense of it and to be more sure-footed in our thinking and more connected as human beings. So as you know, one of the chapters I talk entirely about, it's session 17, it's about reimagining school. Mm-hmm. And within schools and within many of our social institutions, including the media, when you think about what sells, it's what's negative. So we're coming from what's known as a deficit perspective. What's wrong with something, what's broken, you know, and of course there's, again, the sensationalism across the news. But it's very easy to grab people's attention and hold it when we stoke their fear instincts. And these are the kinds of things that people remember, that they tune into, and that, again, that sell. You know, when we think about the last campaign, for example, they were framed as gushers. You know, the major and the number of different outlets has significantly decreased. So now I think there's like about 6 or 8 companies that own all the major media sources. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sort of in contrast to that, we have all these alternative sources as well. So we're getting this big bombardment of information. But with Mentelligence, what I've come up with is, you know, specific activities centered on becoming more grounded thinkers and really breaking away from just sort of the popularized, you know, quick fix types of ways that can lead us to become unconscious. So the first aspect, the first lens is called the reflective lens. And I call it the step in the up. And again, within that lens, it helps us rethink success. So kind of moving away from fake it till you make it to more agile thinking. The other big finding in my study was around something called collective efficacy. And that's actually an extension of the social psychologist Albert Bandura. I don't know if you know his work, but he talks about self-efficacy or personal agency. So it just basically means if you think you can set a goal, you're more likely to, if you think you can reach one, rather, you're more likely to set it and then go on to reach it. So, you know, that's very common sense. But with collective efficacy, and this is something overwhelmingly I saw across my students, it was the movement away from a performance mindset. I've got to be right. I've got to be the best. I've got to compete, to an impact mindset, a mindset of purpose, a mindset of presence. One that, again, was focused not only on the I or the me, but on the we. And so that movement from me to we is the collective efficacy. And so when we wake up, we rethink our unconscious behavior. Like, again, a lot of us, you know, I think a little kids now, like they're already talking about what college they're going to go to. So it's this whole thing of got to do more, got to do more, got to beat out everybody. And as human beings, we're actually capable of so much more. We're capable of what's called metacognition, which is just a fancy way of saying thinking about thinking. So we can be reflective and we can say, no, I'm not going to, you know, buy into this stuff, and I'm not going to buy into the fault for evidence-based thinking. I'm going to look for things that have substance and that are going to really help me make the decisions that I need to make to be effective. So the waking up, again, is finding your reflective lens and really just refocusing, sort of, you know, decompressing your mind and knowing that much of what's being sold is likely to not have the substance behind it that helps us to make effective decisions and that helps us to be conscious global citizens. So this is all about, you know, not only, you know, just affecting change and just our small world, you know, people that are around us that maybe look like us or think like us, but how do we improve in ways that allow us to bring more of collective impact? So that's the waking up aspect.
Yeah, you're sort of speaking about our evolutionary process as a species, as human beings. And there are times when we look around, and again, we're looking at the various outlets, whether it's your phone, your tablet, your laptop, TV, radio, newspapers. And you're getting that information, and some people figure it's not worth it. You know, I mean, it's all going to come to an end because this country is going to launch their missiles, or that country is going to do this, or our country is going to do that, or we're going to have this kind of event happen here and there. Now, along the lines of what you're talking about, a thought that had occurred to me, and I have shared this with great respect with other people in conversation, only to prove a point, and really it goes to your point as well. On December 11th of 2001, I was awakened at about 5:36 a.m. by my radio station asking me if I was watching TV and knew what was going on. I said, no, I'm not a clue, because I had just woken up. And I flipped the TV on, and what I was watching, my first reaction was, wow, Hollywood, they've really done an unbelievable job. Wow, this is incredible. And of course, the story rolls on. And I made the comment to someone the other day, if you really want to codify all of what's been going on in the last couple of years here in 2016, 17, 18, I'll put it to you this way. I wasn't in New York. All I was getting was images on TV. So I don't know that that event really happened because I wasn't there. If I'm not somewhere in the physical, in person, at a particular event, it didn't happen. And that's really where we're at today, is a lot of people, they're saying, hey, I wasn't there. I don't know. So it didn't happen. But then there are others who weren't there, who don't have a clue about what's going on, but they'll say that it did happen. And this is, I think, one of the problems that we have. I keep hearing from different news outlets on all of the different sides of the teams making various claims about different things. And I'm going, where did you get your information? And was it properly vetted? And I think about that in terms of our education. I mean, you know, you're talking about this aspect of critical thinking as well, in the context of mentelligence, and I'm just wondering, is this something that you teach in your classes and online and in other areas to try to wake people up and to get them to realize that maybe what they have been told about particular events or individuals or what have you may or may not necessarily be the truth because all the information isn't in the race, so to speak, the race isn't over yet.
Well, I think you're raising, you know, when I'm thinking about your example of 9/11, I'm thinking about, you know, a continuum of types of theories that people can draw on, you know, to make conclusions. And, you know, when I think about that particular example, I would be cautious, you know, because I think there is a significant amount of reasonable evidence. And I think that brings us back to the critical thinking schematic, you know, to really, you know, because certainly I think, you know, you can start to think about more of like the continuum towards the side of conspiracy theories, right? And so those can get pretty complicated. And I don't necessarily think that we have to, you know, it's really everybody's, you know, prerogative, if you will, or decision to make to what extent they trust reasonable evidence. And so, you know, in your example, you're saying, if I don't see it, there's no reason, you know, I wouldn't believe it.
Yeah,
so
if I wasn't there in person.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that there's lots of ways we can gather information and evidence and see, you know, the myriad of, like in that example, I happen to work with the survivors of 9/11. At the time, I was a younger clinician and I was also doing a lot of program work. So that's a very near and dear thing. It's a sensitive issue for me. But I think, you know, in an example like that, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence, even if someone was not physically there. But to kind of take it back to your point about, you know, the tie-ins with Mentelligence and the ways in which in my classroom and in my public work, how I support critical thinking, again, it's allowing us to recognize the perils and the trappings of this modern day. So some of the things we've been talking about, and then again, our primitive instincts. So in one of the aspects of my model, I talk about breaking out and finding your global lens. And one of the things that I ask people to think about or to rethink is insularity. So insularity is just a fancy way of saying, oftentimes we kind of hang out on our own islands, you know, we tend to maybe gravitate towards similar people, people who might look like us or think like us. And that can lend itself to something known as groupthink. And really, you know, groupthink can be dangerous because, and again, I think in this sort of rapid fire way that information is transmitted, it can really stoke the fires of groupthink. And what we have to, you know, this sort of this paradox as human beings where we want to, you know, be a part of things, but we also want to kind of be independent and be a part, right? So it's sort of, you know, looking at ways in which we're informing our opinions and the extent in which they're maybe informed by the groups of origin that we belong to or our affiliations or people that, again, think along the same lines and just be more conscious that we need to look at life through a global lens and a universal lens. And it's not just because it's the right thing to do, but it's also because it allows us to have a diversity of perspective that's very rich. It helps us to be less rigid and more agile. So, for example, one of the things that I think is astonishing in the millennial generation, who I think, by the way, oftentimes take too much slack, they get bashed, they get dumped on, they, you know, people say they're not just lactose intolerant, they're life intolerant, and they need all this bubble wrap and whatnot. And there's sort of a lot of bullying that goes against this generation. But one of the things that they've done is they've worked to help deconstruct the gender binary. And binary basically just means, you know, you're either in one category or the other. And with gender stuff, they're talking about the fluidity that is just part of that spectrum. And that's one of the things that even happens in the mental health world, and in so many ways, we're now understanding that things aren't just one category or one box or one way, that human beings and life and complexity are very multidimensional. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the global lens, is that if we're just sort of locking down on one theory or one way of seeing the world, that really just ends up escalating our biases And it prevents us from moving towards human solidarity, for looking for the spaces where we do have common ground. And it also leads to greater polarization. And so breaking out is really adopting a wider spectrum, a wider way of seeing ourselves in the world, and, you know, really rethinking our way to this good life, a good life that allows us to have these diverse connections and ways of seeing things. And so that part, I think, is vital, because groupthink is such a powerful force that really prevents us from seeing beyond and, you know, finding space to entertain multiple possibilities and not just thinking we have to be one way or the other in order to be acceptable or good or the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let me say that in my example, I mean no disrespect to anyone. I do believe that it did happen, just as I believe that the Holocaust happened, just as I believe the Earth is round, in spite of the fact that a gentleman you may have read about in the news just recently, who launched himself into the sky pretty doggone high and hurt his back, from what I understand. But his goal was to prove that the Earth was flat like a big Frisbee. And I'm going, in this day and age, really? Okay, hey, you know, if you believe it's flat, hey, more power to you. you know, but it is rather interesting. And again, it is all based in, from my perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's based upon the information that we're exposed to, or that we're willing to expose ourselves to. I mean, how many of us are willing to begin the process, as I have done over the last 40 some odd years, of researching other philosophies to see what they say, not to try to approve or disprove, mm-hmm. but to try to understand where people are coming from who have adopted that particular philosophy. I mean, I remember we lived next door, my family and I, a Roman Catholic family of eight, you know, living up to the papal edict of being fruitful and multiplying. We lived next door to a family of Mormons.
Uh-huh.
And one day I wanted to go to church with them. I wanted to see what that was like. And so I did. And when my mother found out about it that Sunday afternoon or late morning, she says, and you're going to Mass now. And I ended up going to Mass, which was okay. That's fine. But because I was curious. The same thing happened when I interviewed a gentleman who in my early days in broadcasting, who was involved in the unification, if you will, through an organization called CAMP, Camp, Christians and Muslims for Peace. And this was back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I remember after my boss heard the interview, the first question out of his mouth was, are you a Muslim? And I said, no, I'm just curious. I want to know where these... I've had on this program, Tell Me Your Story, I've had Scientologists on. But I didn't tell the listeners where these people were coming from at the outset, because I knew the moment I said, and these folks are Scientologists, boom, they would turn off.
Right. And that even happens, you know, if someone knows I'm a psychologist or behavioral science, or I'm an academic, right, automatically there's a trigger there. Oh, she must be this, or, she, you know, some obviously, oh, she might be liberal or this or that, or all these labels.
Yeah.
And I love your antidote to this, which is, again, this curiosity, this openness, like, I want to just be open to learn your perspective. And, you know, just kind of going back to your example with attending service with your Muslim neighbor, you know, if you look at really, this is, I think, for me too, because I've been on such a quest with this in my own life. I was raised in a very precise tradition as well. And so, but I think one of the greatest discoveries is seeing the common synergy and the things that are apparent in many of the frameworks. And I think what happens in the news and the lack of discourse is that, you know, we other people, right? We get insular, and then it's us versus them, and sort of this whole mindset of, you know, us against the world. But when you look at these frameworks, there's always present something known as ethics of reciprocity, or the golden rule, like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And the Dalai Lama writes very beautifully. He has a book called Beyond Religion. And, you know, he's like this epic, you know, prominent Buddhist who even says, look, all the answers don't just come from a Buddhist framework. And when you look across frameworks again, and they could be academically oriented frameworks, So from like an interdisciplinary level, if you looked at like one sector of science versus another, there's a lot of things that actually connect. And I think this is the beauty and part of kind of where my whole process has taken me is to try to adopt a more integrated view of life and to be able to, again, look at the connections amongst the theories rather than just like, oh, I belong to this and it's right and you're wrong and we can't touch it. And if you go to that service, then you better come to our service now to kind of cleanse yourself here because yeah. God forbid. And one of my favorite activists, she's actually an LGBTQ in the space of really, you know, dismantling a lot of the heterosexism and a lot of the discrimination and oppression that happens for LGBTQ folks is Io Tillett Wright. And there's a quote that says, familiarity is the gateway drug to empathy. So I love your neighbor example. That's exactly that point. It's like, if we get to know someone, you know, and I think the worst part about the news is they'll present the extremists, the people who are bombing places, or like, you know, they'll put those like antagonistic worst voices. And then everybody thinks, okay, this is what a conservative is, or this is what a liberal is, mm-hmm. because they're taking like the most polarizing, you know, like just anxiety provoking, frustrating, like anger inducing examples. And we're not understanding, again, that that's just done to bolster ratings and to get us to fight and to take our eye off the ball, which is that it's the hierarchies, it's the people that are in control. They'd much rather have a situation where we're fighting versus working together. When we work together, it's going to cause us to open a bigger eye, a wider eye, to be able to see that it's their systems of oppression, it's their ways of leading and ruling that are damaging. And I think a lot of us, you know, there's a concept called intersectionality. So intersectionality helps us, you know, whether we've experienced discrimination or oppression because of race or class or gender or sexual orientation or our age, ability, size, all those things, right, that people will bash us for. If you maybe, you know, maybe you're not a person of color, but maybe you can say, you know what, I grew up poor, so I understand what certain things feel like. And that's the part I think in our that really links us in our shared humanity is understanding that these systems and these ways of operating that, you know, societies, again, are very hierarchical, they end up being the things that really, you know, stunt human progress and they distract us and they disrupt us. So part of this whole critical thinking process is recognizing, you know, and my last part of the model is going beyond and rethinking the stagnation that comes with all of that and be able to really come away from our silos and move to integration, to move to finding connecting points, to staying very curious. I love that point you made. Just being open-minded, knowing that we're going to continue to, you know, always have new discoveries, new innovation. I love to just give the example of, I used to like to play basketball and I tore out my ACL. And I had the ACL repair in 1992, and then I had it again 10 years later in 2002. Now, can you imagine me going to my doctors in Boston and saying, oh, you know, don't worry about all those advances in science and technology and medicine over the last 10 years. Go ahead and use the same old scalpel that you used last time. Like, I don't mind, you know? Mm-hmm. Of course not. I'd be crazy to do that, right? Instead, they're going to, you know, you can imagine the recovery time, everything that they did that 10 years later was so much more advanced and so much more effective in my healing process. The same thing is true in our advances in brain science, our advances in mental health, you know, there's so in education. We now have the knowledge that can help us institute better practices. We know what makes human beings thrive and flourish. We have the information. But again, across companies, schools, institutions, sometimes we're operating like we have a hangover from the 1950s, like we're breaking out that old scalpel. And we've got to really be conscious and realize we've got much more awakened practices, things that we know are proven to work. And instead of all this hoopla, what if we were to refocus our energies on discovering those things and then trying them out? and doing it in a more conscious way. That's really how we can become more agile and mindful and connected. Because again, we can fall prey to mindless behavior. And I'm telling you, I think we're all tired, no matter what end of the political, you know, debate we find ourselves on or where we position ourselves. I think we're all universally tired. And I think we know better, and I think we can find a better way together. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I call this being a skeptimist, right? So you can tell I like to blend words, right, Richard? But it's being a healthy skeptimist. We're skeptical of what's being sold to us, but we're optimistic that we can take these levers of today, the new science, the look at, again, the ways that we're making progress and the prejudices we've overcome and the progress we've made. It's not being featured on the nightly news, but we're making progress. And we do live statistically in the most peaceful and prosperous time with the most advances in democracy ever. And that's not to oversimplify or minimize the major disparities. But again, we don't recognize how much ground, you know, how much traction we've made and how much more we can. So I definitely have a blend of skepticism and optimism in my outlook. But at the same time, you know, we can't ignore today's work environments are being called modern hazards. They're saying that 1 in 3 of us are reporting high anxiety, that depression is the global crisis of today, that 350 million of us are affected by. Worldwide suicide is now taking more lives than natural disasters and violence combined. So we've got to do better. We've got to think better. And we've got to harness the many resources that we have across societies and work together. Because, you know, all of us are affected by these things. How many of us are affected by the opioid crisis or have a family member struggling with depression or anxiety? I think we all are touched by these things. And they are all connected to this major problem, the socio-political issue of a lack of thinking and a lack of regarding each other as important and being curious and open to one another.
Well, I find it kind of ironic in one sense, using your medical example, they are literally bringing back the use of leeches, okay? that's but sometimes the old stuff is good too, and it's a good to blend the concepts. We're talking with Kristen Lee, Dr. Chris, Mentelligence, a new psychology of thinking. You can learn learn what it takes to be more agile, mindful, and connected in today's world. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we are really excited to have our guest on the program, and we ask you to stay with us because we are going to continue this conversation.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I'm here with author and clinician, researcher, and so forth, Dr. Kristen Lee, EDD, and it's LICSW. Thank you for staying with us here on the program to talk more about Mentelligence. And I understand that you have another book coming out soon. It is the Kristen Lee Dictionary of combined words. What's that?
That's a great one. They're called portmanteaus, right? All the mashup words.
Yeah, it's amazing. And again, that's how we get a lot of the words. I have to say one of the words that I came up with because, and you said at the end of the last segment how tired. I'm exhausted. I am spent. I got sucked in to the 2016 campaign in September of 2016, and I fought like mad not to. It took me 6 months to get unsucked, and the best way that I was able to do that was to look from a different perspective through using your vernacular, a different lens. Maybe you can tell me which lens I was looking through. At not only the situation, but also the individuals, and say, thank you, teacher, for teaching me the way I don't want to be. I don't want to behave. And I've even used this. If I spoke to my mother, even at my age of 57, if I spoke to her in the way that this individual has been speaking to the various groups of people and individuals, my cheeks would be very red from being slapped multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I've only been slapped by my mother once or twice back when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I never made that mistake again. So that was how I have been able to sort of make peace with all of this, as well as not watch and listen to all of the outlets, and say, thank you, teacher. Same thing with driving. Someone said to me not long ago when I talked about how frustrated I would get with people doing stupid stuff, they say, well, yeah, but what you don't understand, Richard, is that they aren't waking up this morning saying, I'm going to text everybody, let's get Richard. That's not how it works. In a way, that's even worse because they're completely oblivious of some of the stuff that they're doing. But it's not personal. And so I was realizing, okay, all right, then I can calm down because they're not out to get me. You know, if anybody's out to get me, it's me. I'm curious, what lens would you say as far as the teacher when I look at this situation and these individuals and say, thank you for teaching me the things that I don't want to be and the ways I don't want to live and so forth? Because like what you've described, I want to thrive. I'm tired of surviving. I want to thrive and I want to get everybody else in that same place of thriving, because that's where, in my opinion, that's where the excitement is.
Absolutely. And I love like just your demonstration of consciousness and sort of, again, I think for so many of us, that election was very, very provocative. And I think, you know, it's not just happening in the United States, where there's popularized candidates, making their way into these leadership roles. And again, using strategies of fear and aggression, and, you know, just, you know, it's not just, you know, something that's happening here. I think when we think about those in our lives who have influenced us in a positive way and taught us to be conscious, it really spans across all the lenses in the Mentelligence model. So, for example, one of the things that the research overwhelmingly shows us now is that when we're hyper-focused on ourselves, like in kind of like a me, myself, and I way, that does not necessarily cause us to be very effective in helping one another, nor does it really help us be happier people. And so the shift, again, is looking at ourselves as conscious global citizens, those who are really focused on the greater good. And again, this is back to sort of the idea of collective efficacy, the idea that when you do well, I do well. And when you hurt, I hurt. And it's understanding that across boundaries, across territory, that we are connected in deep ways as human beings and that our actions matter. So even just if you're to take it on a simple level, like just the fact of basic manners, and I think that's kind of to your point around the ways you might have been disciplined if you were rude. And I think, you know, just that in general, you know, how do we continue in our own lives, however old we are, and if we're in a role where we're teaching or we're parenting, you know, how do we instill those ethics and those values of basic human regard? You know, again, not looking to just squash someone and compete against them or to other them or to criticize them because they're different or they're not like us. You know, those, again, are systems of power over. You know, this dynamic that, you know, there's these hierarchies and people kind of want to scramble to get ahead and beat the other person out. Again, we know that that does not produce positive outcomes for anybody. It doesn't make them happier. And in fact, it just really damages human progress. So when, you know, you've had this great opportunity to learn just that basic human regard, that is, again, going to help you become more connected, more mindful, more of a global citizen who has the ability then to bring impact. And what I found in my study was that those of my students who were able to kind of move away from those me mindsets to the we mindsets, really started their place of healing. They were able to really, you know, flourish, cultivate resilience, and just have a stronger sense of identity. And we know that, like, if you look at philanthropists, if you look at lots of studies just in terms of giving, whether it's giving our time, our resources, our money, our energy, when we give to each other, when we're connected with each other, we know that the outcomes are much more positive. So I think that, again, for all of us, just seeing what's gone on and seeing the violence and the hatred and, you know, just everything that's at large, it's exhausting. It's demoralizing. It's disgusting, right? And I think that at the end of the day, we can sometimes harness even all of that discord and all of the negativity, and we can harness it for good. And I think that, you know, a lot of the poison's been spilled out, and we're seeing, you know, just again, the terrible fighting that's happening and the terrible polarization. And I think it allows us then to say, what can we do to do better? How can we mobilize our resources? And how do we break down these systems that are damaging all of us?
Yeah. I think that's a good point, that I think that a lot of the negativity has been poured out. It's not been easy by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, a lot of times that's what's necessary. I mean, if you think about it from, say, a medical perspective, going back to your analogy in that regard, one of the processes that the human body goes through is it generates a fever. It heats up. And that heating up has to do with the body's immune system going after and trying to take care of that particular situation that's going on in the body, even to the extent if it's, let's say you broke your arm, it heats up because the body's trying to heal. That's the natural process of things.
That's right.
So you got to go through that and sweat it out, you know, and we have in many instances. I happen to also watch Sky News out of the UK, and I get a lot of information, a lot of good stuff, too. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stories that come out of the UK that you don't get in the United States. You don't hear about what's going on in other parts of the world when you're not connected from that standpoint. But I only watch that, let's say, on a Sunday morning. I'll watch that for maybe an hour, because then they repeat pretty much the next hour and the next hour. And at least I can see where, okay, yeah, well, they're still doing the same silly stuff to one another. Oh, well, that's nice that somebody's being kind and considerate and compassionate to their fellow man and their fellow animals and so on and so forth. And hey, that's kind of neat. It's, you know, all hope is not lost. Because I know that a lot of people, they kind of feel that way. It's like, oh my gosh, we've gone down the rabbit hole and we're never getting out. Mm-hmm. But this isn't the first time that this has happened. Maybe not in this way, but, you know, we've gone down this path a number of times, and hopefully one of these times we will learn. And I have to take a great example from the youth in this country, especially during the month of March, when they had the massive rallies, not just in Washington, not just across the United States, but around the world. The youth were basically saying, hey, we have had enough. And to that point, I had an interview with a gentleman who, he goes to the Middle East quite regularly, and he holds interfaith gatherings, and he gets into conversations with both Israelis and Palestinians. And basically, the young people are telling their parents, mom, dad, you know that skirmish you got going on with the you know, our friends on the other side of the wall, or whatever the case might be, of a different philosophy? That's yours. It's not mine. Mm-hmm. I want no part in it. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we're seeing some hope that eventually, if the parents don't change, they will eventually die off, we hope, of natural causes. And then hopefully that antagonistic bitterness, that Hatfield and McCoy's feuding philosophy will dissipate, because the kids, they just don't want it, because it's not taking them in the direction they want to go to live out their life's purpose, to live meaningful lives, to be part of the, if you will, the collective that helps the society to progress. And I was astounded when he told me that. I thought it was great.
I'm equally, you know, moved by the youth and this movement, and I think they've inherited a mess that they didn't deserve to inherit. And so I think that we need to lock arms in solidarity and, you know, just create the space to really provide the support and to really fight for social change and social policy movement that is going to be more protective. And again, I think, you know, this is really, you know, I was spent the last 5 years on this project, you know, first teaching and then the study and then writing of the book. And, you know, I had finished the writing before the election and, you know, already that things had just become so escalated. And really, at the end of the day, the better thinking that we can adopt helps us then inform social policy. You know, the social policies are things, you know, and the money, it's all about policy and money, right? So the money has to be allocated to better education, to better mental health services, to demonstrating the evidence. Like, you know, it's not my main area of expertise, but I know in some of the reading that I've done, when we look just as this example of guns, right, in the U.S., you know, we have a preposterous amount of guns when we compare it against any other nation. It's like a ridiculous percentage. And then the types of guns and, you know, again, I don't want to get on too much of a divergent path with that, but
no.
It's a key issue is, how do we, you know, just use our senses? And, you know, again, certainly people have very strong opinions and positions, but, you know, how are we, you know, missing the opportunity to really just say, we want to live in a society where we protect life, where we value human beings, and that we, you know, we can do better than this, that we can have schools that are safe, that we can go to the movies and be safe. And, you know, again, it requires a lot of policy changes, and it requires not only the action of leaders, but all citizens. And that's the idea of being a conscious global citizen. As we all work towards this in our own respective ways, that's going to bring about the social change. That's going to bring about, you know, the demands we make and who we vote for and how we get over just, again, like some of the quick stuff that baits our emotions. And we think a little bit deeper, we can rediscover that we are global citizens and that, you know, we can live in a better way. And again, I do remain hopeful that can happen, but it takes collective action. It can't just be us resting our laurels on a leader. And again, I think when we have times like this, it does mobilize people and it does bring about upward and forward momentum for new ways of thinking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How did you get started on all this? What was the catalyst that told you, gee, I want to go down this road. I want to investigate this. I want to help people to better understand and so forth. And I'm not speaking exclusively or specifically of Mentelligence, but I'm talking about your career and doing the things that you're doing now to better understand the, shall we say, the mindset of humanity or of humankind.
I think it's been in me, you know, I love The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho's book, The Alchemist, and sort of his idea about personal legend. And for me, even as a young child, I grew up in a very small rural town, very white, very insular, not a lot of diversity at all, not a lot of diversity of thought. I also grew up in a very precise religious tradition. And again, we didn't have a lot of contact with people that weren't part of that framework. And so I think, you know, it really started as a child, you know, that longing to be more of a global citizen, to have engagement with the world and not be, you know, sort of in that isolative situation. As a child growing up, those experiences really caused me to want, and I started to read, you know, I was always a reader and I read a lot of memoirs and just try to get my hands on as much literature to offer me different perspectives. When I was in high school, I lost my closest friend to a drunk driving car accident. And at that time, I went into a very severe depression. It was also when I had the ACL repair. So it was kind of like the 1-2 punch. And, that really shaped my desire to go into my clinical work and become a therapist. And so from that point on, for the last 22 years, I have heard thousands of stories, right? And I've seen the common thread in all the stories in human suffering and sort of when someone's dealing with trauma or hardship is that, you know, first of all, people think they're the only ones, right? And then second of all, what we're taught and how we're educated and the types of resources we have really affect our outcomes and our recovery process. And those are called protective factors when it comes to resilience. So I saw all these amazing, extraordinary examples of people recovering from hard things and, you know, healing. And I also saw how much education had an influence on that. And I saw that education could either be transformative or it could traumatize and reify and reemphasize really bad things for people. So it made me realize, you know, how much re-education we needed. And so 9 years ago, I stepped into higher education, really believing that I could be an agent of change within my classroom and beyond, and to really, you know, get stronger in understanding evidence-based practices and get stronger in, you know, like you said earlier, not teaching people what to think, but how to think better and how to really unlearn the damaging stuff that we're sold about ourselves. And, you know, just from like that clinical perspective and the psychology perspective, we're taught kind of a one and done thing, you know, or like that it's taboo or shameful, or we should feel stigmatized if we experience anxiety or depression. And, you know, over time, I really recognize, you know, these are just problems of humanity. And not only are there problems, but we also have all these strengths that we're ignoring. And Marty Seligman, who's the founder of positive psychology, talks about it in this way. He says, you know, everything that we've known about psychology has been half-baked. You know, we're good at diagnosis and deficit thinking and looking for problems and trying to fix problems, but we're leaving out the strengths part of it. We're leaving out this whole other side of the story of the human spectrum, what we're capable of, the healing, the resilience, the agility, all of those things that we're capable of doing. And so I saw that dual narrative in my own life as a person who dealt with my own emotional disruption, my own lived experience with anxiety and depression, my own longings, my own difficulties, my own traumas. And then again, coming into higher ed, then I saw that same narrative repeat with my students who had been shamed in school and taught that they weren't smart or they weren't good at math or they were terrible writers or whatever it was, and yet they kept persevering. And I saw that healing could come in community and through collective action and through the recognition that it's not us that are dysfunctional so much. It's the systems that perpetuate these ideas about normal or good or worthy that we have to deconstruct. And so it's really been a lifelong process of, you know, unlearning and discovering how much progress we can make as human beings when we rethink what we're first sold. And one of my favorite metaphors is the upward spiral, right? So we're often taught something goes wrong, you're going to be on a downward spiral, like you're going to go out of control, the other shoe's going to drop, you're never going to be okay again. But research has shown that we're capable of expanding our positive emotion repertoire and that we're actually capable of upward momentum. And one way I tell my students about this is that learning is everything and everything is learning. And that's that curiosity mindset we've been talking about, right? It's like recognizing even hard stuff is a teacher, even pain and suffering are teachers. And we can forge ahead and harness a tremendous amount of momentum to go upward. And so we don't have to just get stuck or think, oh, you know, I'm so embarrassed of myself. I made this mistake or I took this risk and it didn't pan out. No, just show up honest. Know that that's just part of being human and that we can move forward even when we think that we're done and we think that we're really, you know, embarrassed of our circumstances. So that's really kind of the personal backstory behind what led me to the teaching and what led me to the research. And then in my writing, if you read Mentelligence, you see that I come right out. My first introduction is about me being in therapy and being disrupted and disintegrated. I was kind of living in my headspace and I was mad at the church and I was mad at society and I was dealing with just all these things that came through this process. And at the end of the book, I, you know, share sort of the ways I integrated and how I recognize how indoctrination comes in all forms. And when we unlearn it and we move towards new ways of thinking, it can truly be transformative.
We've used the analogy of a lifeboat. It'll hold seven to 8 billion people. However, there's a catch. You have to be willing to let go of the old ways of thinking because they don't work. Just look around you. And if you can do that, come on board. We need you. We want you. We want you part of the collective, if you will, of the community, even if it is 7 or 8 billion people. And we will get to the place where I hope in my lifetime, it'd be great. My father's, he's in his late 80s, but hey, it's still time. Where we can thrive and stop this survivalism and you know, you want to make a TV show? Fine, go ahead and do Survivor. That's fine. But I'd like to, I want to see a TV show called Thrive.
Yes.
Where people are doing just that. And I think it's fantastic. Kristen, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time here on the program. Dr. Kristen Lee, EDDLICSW. Mentelligence is the title of the book. It's a new philosophy of thinking. Learn what it takes to be more agile, mindful, and connected in today's world. First of all, if you should find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we would really enjoy having you in studio, and we'd love to talk further about this in another interview if you should ever find yourself out here.
I would love that, Richard. That sounds terrific.
And then finally, three final questions for you, and then we'll let you go. And again, thank you. First question is, who is Kristen Lee?
Who is Kristen Lee?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that's a good question. So so I am a human being, and I, for the roles that I do, I'm a lead faculty for behavioral science at Northeastern University. And I also define myself as a recovering perfectionist, a behavioral science expert, and a global citizen. And I'm also a very proud mama of a daughter who's 22 and a son who's 18.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
My hope is to really be a catalyst for a global conversation about what it means to be a conscious global citizen and to help people really recognize ways that they can flourish, ways that they can rethink and unlearn old behavior and pivot to a life that is characterized by more agility, more mindfulness and connection, ways that they can move again away from a performance mindset and more to a purpose mindset.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
So my life's purpose is to be an agent of change and to really help leverage the human condition to help people be able to be more self-compassionate, to be more connected, and, you know, to be more focused on ways we can advance one another.
The book is entitled Mentelligence. It is, again, a new psychology of thinking. The website is Kristen Lee. That's KristenLee.com. And we encourage you to pick up a copy, go to the website, learn more about what she is doing, the work that she is all about. And I believe, am I reading this correctly? You have a Twitter account. Is that right? That is at the real Dr. Chris, K-R-I-S.
That's right, yes. And I share a lot of resources through my website and very active on social media to try to, you know, give people tangible, practical strategies to carry this kind of stuff out. Because we have to do it in community. None of us can do this alone. So feel free to connect with me there for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program today. This has been fantastic. And I do look forward to having you back, whether it's in person or via Skype once again.
Likewise. Take amazing care. Thank you so much, Richard.
You bet. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.